It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
The New Statesman.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
I'm Freddie.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Emma.
And on today's episode of the New Statesman podcast, we discuss Gavin Williamson's resignation, and you ask us, what will a second period of austerity bring? Since we last recorded, Gavin Williamson, who was the sort of whip of Rishi Sunak's leadership campaign and elevated to minister without portfolio in his cabinet, he's resigned from cabinet over bullying allegations. Labour's saying this brings Rishi Sunak's judgment into question because he was aware of a complaint against him when he appointed him. And also, let's not forget Williamson's past. He was sacked by Theresa May after she accused him of leaking from a national security briefing when he was defence secretary. And he was fired in Boris Johnson's reshuffle last September as education secretary after messing up the exam result algorithm during the pandemic and various other failings. Is this another sign of Sunak's weakness, Freddie?
Yeah, completely. I think that's the main takeaway from it, is that Sunak was supposed to be this clean break from the divisiveness and the weakness of Truss and Johnson, but he's not been able to do that, in part because he inherited all of those divisions that already existed. And Gavin Williamson was there to try and manage those things, to try and ensure he could get bills through House of Commons. And the fact that he had this bad history and he still had to bring him into the cabinet just speaks to the fact that Rishi Sunak was much weaker than many people thought.
So it's a bit like a Suella Braverman situation. He felt like he had to have her in for different reasons, but still political expediency.
Completely, yeah. Braverman was there in part as a figurehead for the right of the party. He needed the support of her supporters in the leadership campaign, and that's part of the reason that she stayed on as, or was brought back in as Home Secretary, even though she leaked or shared those sensitive documents 6 days before joining Rishi Sunak's cabinet.
Right, okay. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think although it says something about Rishi Sunak's position, it also says something about the way Westminster works, doesn't it? Because there's been a lot of commentary about the kind of text that Gavin Williamson was sending, but also his whole approach to Westminster politics, which is very much of the kind of dark arts of the whips style, House of Cards-ish. You know, that's the way that some MPs kind of like to characterise themselves. And while there's an acceptance to an extent of that kind of behaviour in Westminster, it looks very strange to the outside world. I think it's the same with that fracking vote where you had those claims about whips trying to force people into the lobbies. You know, it was sort of like, well, this is what it's always been like. This is how it works. But why? You know, I remember when I spoke to Andy Burnham at Labour conference, he actually said something about how the whip system should be abolished. And, you know, people were kind of laughing at his naivety, but actually it does look odd. And Emma, we've got you on. You're our business correspondent for this podcast. And often when you listen in on focus groups or you speak to people who are sort of outside of politics, they wonder why it works in such a way where you could never get away with it in a normal company. And I'm sure you've spoken to business owners who have kind of been rolling their eyes at this kind of schoolyard style of politics.
I mean, I'm the only non-political reporter here, right?
Yeah.
And I look at this stuff. You know, I don't routinely watch PMQs or anything like that. I look at this behaviour and I just think, Jesus Christ, like, what is going on? It's like worse than school. I don't think I behaved like that, at least during senior school. And it is a very weird to sit outside. And obviously, you know, I work for the New Statesman. I'm fairly politically informed, but even Elon Musk, if he behaves like that, physically pushing people into lobbies, okay, is not beyond Elon Musk to keep a tarantula on his desk to intimidate people. That seems like a very Elon Musk thing to do. And if he hears about Gavin Williamson doing it, I would be surprised if he wasn't tempted to copy it. But am I defaming anyone there? I don't think I am. You know, yeah, you couldn't behave like this in a company. So much of what happens in politics, you couldn't do. And if you look at the kind of mini budget fiasco, I think last time I was on, I used a very laboured metaphor about share prices and trying to sell stuff. But, you know, you just can't behave like that in the real world.
But Rachel, is it his behaviour that's meant that he's had to leave cabinet? Or is it more, as he said in his resignation letter, that he was becoming a distraction, which is sort of classic resignation letter speak?
I think sort of Gavin Williamson is like an exceptional case, as in like the amount of times he's been offered a chance and failed. So when you kind of look at his career history within sort of frontline politics in government, he was David Cameron's PPS. Then when Cameron resigned after the Brexit vote, he switched sides and picked Theresa May, became her campaign manager. At the time, there were reports that he'd vowed to get revenge on Boris Johnson for the Brexit vote and David Cameron, what have you. Then when Theresa May won, obviously, he became chief whip. He was kind of then promoted to defence secretary. Mark Sedwill, the head of the civil service, found that he was the one responsible for leaking from the National Security Council. So she had no real choice but to sack him. And then he switched sides again and helped Boris Johnson to oust Theresa May as part of his leadership campaign. And then he switched sides again to Rishi Sunak. And in the meantime, in between those times, he became education secretary during COVID and completely balls that up and was a total mess. I think it says a lot about Rishi Sunak's judgment that he then thought it was a good idea to put Gavin Williamson into his cabinet. As far as I can see it, it's not just a fact that he ignored that there was a bullying claim against Gavin Williamson. He also just ignored this complete balls up of a political career that Gavin Williamson has had.
Hasn't stopped ministers in the past, I have to say.
I don't know if anyone's got away with quite as much as Gavin Williamson has. And I think it kind of says a lot that Rishi Sunak didn't think it was a good idea to actually remove him, and he allowed Gavin Williamson to actually resign instead, and then said that he accepted his resignation with great sadness. It was either for Rishi Sunak to kind of show his authority and act, or to just go into the trenches and try to defend his position. So I just don't think from start to end Rishi Sunak's handled it very well, really.
Yeah, and he was one of five former chief whips that Rishi Sunak promoted, which suggests he knew that the big issue for him, the big priority outside of the policy areas that are very pressing, was party management. And actually, this has exposed the divisions within the party still, because it looked like more and more people were going to come out with evidence about the way Williamson had treated them unless he was axed.
Yeah, completely. I mean, all those briefings in the newspapers, all those rumours, they came from somewhere, and it speaks to the division in the party and those who were anti-Williamson, but also by virtue of that, anti-Sunak. But I think, I don't know, you mentioned this earlier, Anish, I'm not sure how much cut through this story will have. For much of the week, it's been a Westminster story, but the most important things are, as we've discussed, it demonstrating the disunity in the party and also the weakness of Rishi Sunak's position. And that matters in part because we've got the autumn statement next week, which is by far the single most important moment for Rishi Sunak so far. That's when we're going to see which taxes he's going to raise, which spending he's going to cut. And if he doesn't have the unity within his party to get those measures through, then he's very vulnerable to MPs coming forward and saying, you can't do this, you can't do that. I mean, we already had Ian Duncan Smith, I think, this week saying that he didn't want to see the top rate of tax increase. So there's already divisions and debates within the party, and that's going to bleed through to next week.
Yeah, because on every single decision that he has to make, there is now a faction of MPs who would oppose it. So putting benefits up in line with anything other than inflation, you know, we know that a number of former DWP secretaries, including Ian Duncan Smith, would advise against that.
Yeah, and that's why party unity is so important, because the system relies upon having this majority in the House of Commons to enable the government to get through legislation. I mean, that's one of the reasons we've not had much movement within the House in the past 9 months or so, because the Conservative Party has been so divided.
And talking of attack dogs, back to that theme, Rachel, you had a really interesting story recently a few days ago, which I think all our listeners should go and read if they haven't already, that Labour's decided it has enough ideas people in its inner circle and it needs a few street fighters in headquarters. So tell us a bit about what they're planning.
When Rishi Sunak took office after Liz Truss was ousted and before that Boris Johnson was ousted, Labour kind of, well, Keir Starmer rather, came to the decision that this is a very, very divided party. The government could fall apart at any time because of everything that's passed in the last few months. So we'll put the party on an election footing. And as part of that, they're moving out of their current headquarters in Southside to a new building in Southwark. And I found out yesterday that they're actually temporarily based in Millbank. And they're getting a lot more donations because they're seen as, you know, because they've been ahead in the polls for a significant amount of time now by an average of like 20 points ahead in the polls. So they're getting a lot more donations. They've asked Lord Waheed Ali, who is a quite famous Blairite Labour peer. You know, he's very close to Tony Blair. He was an advisor to his government, and he's sort of very good friends with Angie Hunter. Mm-hmm. He's kind of leading all of their fundraising efforts, and they are going to be taking on like more comms people, more what you would consider to be like attack dogs, you know, people to rifle through Conservative Party candidates' social media and to do a lot more of sort of the aggressive briefing against their opponents. So it's just all part of them being sort of very election ready and having a bit more cash in the coffers to be as much.
Interesting. Weird that they didn't already have that in place, though, considering the Tories are quite hot on this stuff.
Yeah, the Conservative Party is very good at looking at Labour MPs and politicians and making sure that any bad thing in their history is out in the open. And I think, for instance, the Conservative Research Department at CCHQ is very good at focusing on these things and ensuring ministers know what their opponents are up to and ensuring that the Labour Party has a really tricky time in the media. So it's very important that parties do that, because you need to frame the narrative and you need to ensure that any movement that your opponent makes is fact-checked or given scrutiny in the media.
I'd kind of take issue with that slightly, considering a lot of people who briefed all of the Keir Starmer Beergate stories thought it was the best thing they'd done in generations, and it fell a little bit flat on its face. But it did manage to stay on the front of the Mail for a few days.
So that was from the Conservative Research Department then, those stories?
They were all driven by Conservative Party figures, yeah, that were kind of pushing the story, briefing journalists about it. But it didn't really go anywhere. But yeah, they're just, the Labour Party hasn't had a lot of money for years now because they've, you know, not been winning elections and not been attracting donations because of that. So yeah, might change, yeah.
Do people expect Labour to be a bit nicer than the Tories on that kind of front? Like a bit less attacky.
I don't know, Labour tends to do a lot of its briefing. It's a bit less obvious than some of the Conservative Party briefing. So you'll see a lot of stories appear that you actually know have come from a Labour briefing and, you know, make the front page of the Times, make the front page of the Sunday Times or what have you. So it's, you know.
Yeah, it's all behind the scenes, I guess. So it's not so much about coming across as aggressive.
A bit more behind the scenes. I don't know if they're nicer.
And actually,
I'm not saying they are nicer. I'm just saying, do people expect them to be nicer?
Well, for Keir Starmer, one of the most annoying things for him in his job is that everyone always says, who's not sure about him sort of in the public, is that he's only ever criticising. Like, why does he only ever have bad things to say about the Conservatives? Why doesn't he have any plans of his own? And actually, that's a really tricky thing, because when you're leader of the opposition, PMQs itself, you're not supposed to be putting forward your own agenda. You're supposed to be picking holes in the government. So, but that's sort of the main bit, the clips that people see most often on the news.
Yeah, the government leads the news agenda. Therefore, the main part that Labour plays is the criticism. That they go, you know, two-thirds down the piece, and you'll see the Labour quote saying, oh, and the government are wrong for doing this because the government are the government, and therefore they're more important because they're making policies and they're impacting everyone's lives. So Labour, they're forced to be reactive in that sense.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the next section. Hi, it's Anoush here. This is just a reminder that as a podcast listener, you have the option of subscribing to The New Statesman with a very special offer. You can subscribe for just £1 a week. That's 12 weeks for £12 if you go to newstatesman.com/podcast offer. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Armando Iannucci.
And I'm Anoush Shakelian. And we present Westminster Reimagined on the New Statesman podcast.
Each episode, we'll be taking a look at how our politics has got so broken and whether there's anything we can do to fix it.
We hear from people shaping our society, from the front line to the corridors of power, alongside campaigners, journalists and satirists, including John Stewart, Ian Hislop, Rosamund Adukisi-Deborah and Catherine Haddon,
You can listen to all three series now. Just search the New Statesman podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Or go to newstatesman.com/Westminster Reimagined.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Now it's time for a section we like to call...
You Asked Us.
And we have a question today from Michael. Thanks so much, Michael. As we enter a potential second period of austerity since 2010, to what extent has Osborne's austerity got us where we are now? For example, many people cited overwhelmed public services as a motivation for voting Brexit. So I think this is a really good question. And I've actually written pieces myself about the prospect of austerity 2.0 and the return of austerity. But actually, you know, perhaps those pieces were framed slightly wrongly because we're still with austerity 1.0 or whatever, the first time round post-crash in 2010. The effects of those cuts are probably being felt around the country more than ever in most demographic groups now. So I think probably the most obvious examples of this political moment would be public sector workers struggling to recruit and retain those public sector workers because they're paid so little. I mean, the public sector pay freeze was such a big part of austerity. And now you see their real wages are far lower than they should be. The Royal College of Nursing has just decided to go on strike for the first time. Annual wage growth is 5%, but for the public sector, it's less than 2%. So you can see why they're struggling to recruit in those jobs. So I'd say that's one of the big impacts. And then, of course, lack of beds and tight resources in our hospitals. You saw that over COVID in very extreme form, but also you're seeing it now with ambulances queuing up outside hospitals. That's all because of the cuts to local government, which provides social care services. There's not enough social care, so people can't be discharged from hospitals. And that's something that Jeremy Hunt, who was health secretary during austerity, actually admitted to me himself. That is why those ambulances are queuing up in hospital car parks. And then I think in general, there is a feeling that the kind of public realm has been neglected and you're sort of losing those spaces that you perhaps remember from 10 years ago. So something that struck me was where I live, the free fireworks display that they'd have every bonfire night is off now. Sounds like a small thing and it's not something that you can really measure, but I do think it just adds a feeling that, you know, your community sort of bit by bit, drip by drip is kind of being ignored. And I'd say that kind of sense of dislocation was part of some of the reasons that some parts of the country voted to leave the EU as well, which is something that Michael suggested in his question. But Emma, you were covering this. I'd like to know your thoughts.
Yeah. Well, I have covered this week and for a piece that's coming out on Friday to coincide with GDP figures, because the Bank of England has warned that we're about to go into a recession that's going to be the longest in a century. And on Friday, we will find out most likely that the economy has gone into its first quarter of many of contraction. So not recession, because recession is two quarters of contraction. But most economists think that it will have shrunk by 0.4%. And then if you compare that with other countries, the US in the third quarter grew 2.6%. The Eurozone grew 0.2%, so not loads. But other economies are still in growth, albeit quite anemic growth. And you can trace this stuff back to austerity, to the original 2010 austerity, because there was such a big drop in investment in this country. And investment is what makes GDPs, economies grow. So there's some World Bank figures kicking around that show that UK investment has been declining since the late 1980s, right? So in 1989, investment was about a quarter of GDP. At the beginning of austerity, so 2010, it fell to its lowest ever, 16% of GDP. At the moment, it's just higher, 17% of GDP. If you compare that again with the US, it's about 21%. Eurozone, it's about 22%. So, you know, our level of investment is significantly lower in this country than it is in other kind of Western economies. And interesting that you bring up the NHS, Anoush, because investment isn't about it is about building bridges and launching tech startups and things like that, but it's also about investing in human beings. And our workforce in the last few years, particularly since the pandemic, has shrunk like catastrophically. 400,000 people have dropped out of the workforce because of long-term sickness. And coincidentally, the NHS is in crisis. And you can really see, you know, you've got this crisis-addled NHS. It's not able to treat people for their long-term sickness, and the economy is losing out. So there was a study that came out recently that found that for every pound spent on health, you get £4 of economic growth. So you can really just see the effects of austerity now, and they're all just kind of coming to a head. And the idea that we're about to go into another period of austerity, to me, suggests a real misunderstanding of economics on Rishi Sunak's part.
Yeah, we actually looked into this, one of our data journalists, Giacomo, and I, into those economic inactivity figures. And I spoke to someone, he was a 31-year-old guy, healthy, worked in housing. And he, I think he trapped a nerve or something in his shoulder, and it was really painful, and he couldn't work. He couldn't go into work. But because the NHS couldn't treat him, a very simple thing, on time, he developed depression because he was at home and couldn't exercise or socialise or work. And that kept him out of the workforce. He dropped out of the workforce. So you can see that's a small example of the way that this is, like you say, that growth is very much related to the strength of our public services. And Rachel, I mean, does this put Labour in a bit of a tricky position? Because, I mean, I've heard that there's a little bit of disagreement at the top of how much they should go on the opposing austerity 2.0 thing, because after all, they have been talking about the magic money tree and how irresponsible it was for the government to borrow for those tax cuts in that brief administration. Where do they go on this?
I think they're probably, their strategy will be to say as little as possible. I think
that's the spirit.
That's been their strategy for the last couple of years. And I think they'll take that to absolute fever pitch when it comes to the autumn statement that's coming up. I just think that they will try to make sure that everything that's happening has landed squarely with the governing party and not with them. So they will not volunteer their position. It's only if they'll ever be forced into votes on it or what have you that they'll go any further. But they have said a few things that they want, which would include some of the things that have already been briefed out by the government, you know, bringing welfare into line with inflation. But I don't think you will have, you know, a very big deal. Here are the dividing lines between Labour and the Conservative Party at the autumn statement. I don't get the sense that that's the direction they're headed in.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Because that's sort of the dilemma that Miliband had, didn't he, about accepting sort of the government's public finances, basically.
Yeah. As soon as you accept that framework, yeah, you have to work within it. I mean, both the Conservatives and Labour have their own fiscal rules, which are the main constraints on what they can do. And Labour have already set those fiscal rules, and they said they're going to stick by them. The problem for them is they don't know where the economy is going to be in 2 years' time or whenever they potentially come into government. So it's very hard for them to say to the public, this is what the government's doing, but this is what we would do instead, because they can't write their manifesto now. So they have to criticise the government in their own terms, which sort of, as you said, means accepting their framework, which sort of restricts the economic debate within some, you know, Sunak's fiscal conservatism.
And as Emma said, the mistake here would be to respond to this recession in the same way that we responded to the last recession, which actually led to very sluggish growth, wage stagnation.
Yeah, quite. I mean, one of the best arguments against austerity, which is coming to the fore again now, is just that it was a false economy, you know, in lots of different ways. You mentioned NHS spending there, but also for other departments, if you cut spending in prisons, for instance, yep, what you see 5 years later is just a massive injection of emergency funding because the services are going to crisis. So it doesn't always work out that you just cut departmental spending and then that helps you in the long term.
Yeah. Okay. And we'll talk more about what the autumn statement might contain next week, because that, you know, we will see the extent of the cuts next week. But thanks so much, all of you, for coming on. That was a great discussion.
Thanks, Anish.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, my colleagues, Freddie Haywood, Rachel Wearmouth and Emma Hazlitt. We're produced by Mae Robson, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks so much for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.